I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Newspapers from states like Connecticut and Texas and Utah are reporting what they call a growing rebellion over the No Child Left Behind law. The quarrels vary from state to state, but in almost every case, it's a disagreement over money. No Child Left Behind has set up a rigorous testing regime to raise the quality of education in schools that need the help the most. And most people think that's a pretty good idea. The trouble is that many people are accusing Washington of skimping on the money, forcing states to make up the difference. After 3 years, a number of states and school districts and the National Teachers Union are either planning to or taking the Education Department to court. Now, it could mean, in the long run, the end of No Child Left Behind, because the act is meant to be a national program, and if some states decide to follow their own standards, well, then it stops working. So what do you think should happen? Are you in favor of nationwide testing? Has that testing become the focus and the only benchmark for the nation's students and teachers? And can No Child Left Behind work as a way to help the students who most need that help? Or is it time to leave No Child Left Behind behind? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me today, Katie Haycock. She is in the NPR studios in Washington. Katie is director of the Education Trust, one of the architects, and one of the strong backers of No Child Left Behind. Katie, thanks for coming in.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And in that same studio with Katie, David Shreve. David is Senior Committee Director on Education for the National Conference of State Legislatures. Hello, David.
Good morning.
Can I start with you, David, just because you're in that state legislature building in Washington? I'm curious to know what kind of priority the No Child Left Behind controversy is getting there. Is that sort of a number one concern among states these days?
It depends on the state, and it depends on what other issues they have before them, but it certainly is an important issue in a lot of states.
Because I'm wondering, with all that different list of complaints that I was referring to in the open that come, you know, it's different in Texas and Utah and Connecticut, and it's different from school district to school district. Is there anything that links all those complaints together? Is there any one big thing that we should be focusing on here?
Well, I think the thing that links them together is their frustration with trying to implement a law that they're finding increasingly difficult to implement, not only because of the money, but just because of the structure of the law. And you've got a number of states across the country that are expressing that frustration in different ways. Some of it is being expressed through legislation at the state level.
Right.
Some of it's being expressed through litigation. And some of it's being expressed by what I just call open civil disobedience of the federal law.
Katie, do you see this as a growing rebellion against the No Child Left Behind?
Let's remember here. For many, many years, we've maintained a deeply inequitable educational system in this country. Most states actually spend less on schools serving poor kids than they do on schools serving affluent kids. Affluent kids go to school in brightly lit buildings with well-educated teachers and brand-new textbooks, while poor kids and kids of color are educated in dingy buildings with teachers who don't know what they're teaching. It's not surprising that when the federal government pushes on trying to solve these problems, states get upset. I mean, the federal government historically is supposed to stand up for the kids who get left behind in state education systems. They started that back in the 1950s and 60s by saying you got to provide an education for poor kids and kids of color, and you can't continue to do it separately for others. They picked that up in the 70s by saying you're leaving disabled students out. We got to provide quality education for them as well.
And let me ask you something, though, Katie. I mean, a number of the people who stand as critics of No Child Left Behind say they like the principles of the act. They think that its aim is, you know, honorable to do the work that you're talking about. What they're saying is that there isn't enough money to do that. Is that a valid criticism?
There's never enough money, if you ask the question that way, to do what we want to do in education. But that is really a combination of state stinginess with schools serving poor kids and of a federal government that has been stingy, too. But the real question you have to ask is, if you don't get what some people consider enough money, should that be a reason to say, well, gee, I guess we shouldn't try to get all kids to higher levels of achievement after all. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we ought to leave a quarter behind or perhaps 30% behind because we have 30% too few dollars. The important thing here is we have been systematically undereducating lots and lots of kids in this country. As a result of that, by the end of high school, Black and Hispanic kids, for example, have skills about the same as the average white 13-year-old. Not because they can't learn at higher levels, but because we've provided them an education that doesn't get them to those higher levels.
Let me just step in for half a second here. We want to hear from people who are at the ground level where the complaints are coming from. I want to bring Randall Eigelhardt in now. He teaches ESL in the Mark Twain Middle School in San Antonio, Texas. He's joining us on the line from his home there. Hello, Randall.
Good morning, Dick.
What are you teaching? Is that an inner city school that you're in?
Yes, sir. It certainly is.
So you've got a mix of, I would guess, in San Antonio, a fair number of Latino students?
Yes, that makes up the majority.
Now, you just did your annual test this week for No Child Left Behind. Is that right?
Yes, we just completed a week of our standardized testing, the TAX test, as we call it, Texas Assessment of Knowledge and Skills.
How are the students doing?
How are they doing?
Yeah. How did they do on the test? Do you know?
I really can't say how they did. The test has to go in and be scored, and then we receive the results back in several weeks. But I can tell you this, they tried their hardest.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you, though, Randall, is if you're teaching ESL, then some of the money that we're talking about, the No Child Left Behind money, is supposed to be helping you do the work, bring these kids along more quickly. Is it helping?
Well, of course, money does help, and it goes back to the question of amounts, because Texas has a growing LEP population, limited English proficiency population, of the English language learners, and so with that increase, consequently, you will need more money.
So do I mark you down as a supporter of No Child Left Behind?
I think, in theory, No Child Left Behind had good intentions. But it has been creating a number of problems with the school districts here in Texas, including our school district, I think.
What's the principal problem? What would you say is the number one problem from your perspective, the classroom perspective?
Well, from my perspective, I think the number one problem is flexibility. There is no flexibility or very little in dealing with No Child Left Behind. Another problem, though, is phasing it in. There is really not sufficient time, and they're not allowing a sufficient time to phase the program in adequately, particularly when you have a state like ours that has already set up an accountability system.
So are you saying that there's too much testing? Is that a part of it?
Well, that is definitely part of it, because, you know, with all this testing comes analysis of the tests, all this additional paperwork and what have you that is generated, and that has to be filled out, and all the documentation that occurs with all of this. And all of this has gone to take away or become a distraction to actual classroom teaching as we see it. When you're spending all of your time giving tests and analyzing test data, you're taking away time from classroom preparation as well as classroom instruction when you're teaching test-taking skills and you're modeling your tests after the standardized tests, as well as giving end of grading period tests that also model this test. I mean, there comes a point when you have to stop and say, whoa, are we doing the right thing for our students here?
Randall, just one more question, if I can. You're also state president of the Association of Texas Professional Educators, and some people say that a lot of this criticism is really coming more from the union than it is from the classroom level. Is that a fair criticism?
No, sir, that is not a fair criticism. This is coming from teachers around the state of Texas. You know, I travel the state, and I visit with teachers, and no, this is coming from teachers at large, in general. This is not just a union situation.
Thank you for being with us, Randall.
Yes, thank you.
Randall Eigelhardt there joining us on the line from San Antonio, Texas. David Shreve, the complaints, I mean, there's lots of criticism about who's really behind this. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think if you look, if you want to find a conspiracy, you can always find a conspiracy. I don't think there's one there. And again, I think if you look across the country at the variety of responses to the similar circumstances and the similar expression of frustration, you'll see that this isn't a conspiracy. It's just an expression of what happens when you try to put an inflexible law over a very broad and flexible system across the country.
And so when the Secretary of Education, Margaret Spelling, says, look, you know what? We should be talking about flexibility. I'm willing to talk about flexibility. Doesn't that answer Randall's concern and some of the concern, David, that you have?
Well, you have to talk about flexibility, but you also have to be willing to grant the flexibility that states need to implement this law. And as we looked at the circumstances around the country when our task force met over the last year, we found in innumerable circumstances where flexibility wasn't there and right. was causing not only making it problematic to implement the law, but was ending up with some very sort of bizarre unintended consequences that were opposite the promises of the law.
Katie, we have to go to a break in just a moment, so I'm wondering if I can ask you to be brief. But when you listen to the conversation about it being too hard to fix or fixable, how easy would it be to resolve all these difficulties that we're hearing about?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is some of the difficulties are in the process of being resolved right now. Difficulties around the assessment of disabled students, for example, and I think the same is true about assessment of limited English proficient students. But do remember that underneath the request for flexibility are a set of states that simply really don't want to do what the law asks them to do at all, and that is to provide a quality education to poor children.
Connection listeners, is No Child Left Behind working in your child's school? Is this something that is, in fact, helping the students who really need that help, or is it getting in the way? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, a conversation about No Child Left Behind. It's been much in the news in the past couple of weeks, if you've been paying any attention. One of the series of stories coming from Utah, where the Utah State Legislature recently voted to uphold, in effect, to uphold its own education standards over those of No Child Left Behind. It's seen in many quarters as a pretty direct challenge to the federal law and could, in fact, mean the loss of millions of dollars of federal money that would normally go to the state of Utah to help with students there. Now, the reporting out of Utah was that it was overwhelmingly passed by the legislature there. But we have with us on the line Dwayne Bordeaux. He's a Democratic state representative from Salt Lake City, and he's one of the few people who voted against this. Hello, Dwayne.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm interested in your perspective on this. Why do you think Utah? Well, start off with a simple one. What's going on in Utah? What's the main complaint?
I think the main complaint is what others have stated this morning, NCSL David Shreve, and the flexibility. It's a state's rights issue. My colleagues say we don't want the federal government coming in telling us how to run our system locally.
Is it fair then to say if it is a state's rights issue, then the states need to step up and do more to help minority kids?
Absolutely, and that's my argument in our state. This problem didn't arise overnight. There's been an achievement gap for some time, and I don't feel we've done enough to close that achievement gap for kids of color, and it's very problematic, and I hope my colleagues will move forward and work towards setting a solid goal in regards to closing that achievement gap.
I know it's a cliche, Dwayne, but do you think that the legislature there is throwing the baby out with the bathwater on this one?
You know, well, you really have to ask yourself first, when you really start talking about a state's rights issue, and if we're a voice of the people, and that's my argument on the floor, if we're a voice of the people and the minority community has come forward and says, we want this achievement gap closed, and we can't stand to lose $76 million when we're 51st on the country in per pupil spending.
Yeah.
You have to ask yourself, is this political rhetoric? What's really the issue at hand here? And then the concerning aspect comes to the minority community saying our needs are not being met.
But David Shreve, can you just join this part of the conversation with Dwayne? What are you hearing something that conflicts with what Dwayne's talking about in Salt Lake City?
Not hearing anything that conflicts directly, but I think in talking about this issue, you can't talk about it only as a states' rights issue. That narrows it to the point that it doesn't do it justice. The argument in Utah has been and continues to be that they have an accountability system, which is the sort of the measuring stick by which you plug student test scores into and figure out whether a school or a district is failing or passing. The accountability system in Utah, according to the folks in Utah and according to a lot of other people, is a lot more sophisticated and a lot better suited to measure the problems in Utah and to determine who's making growth and who's not making growth. The accountability system required under No Child Left Behind, Adequate Yearly Progress, measures cohorts of kids against one another. In other words, it measures what a fifth grade math class does this year versus what a fifth grade math class does next year.
Yeah.
So you're comparing apples to oranges, and not only apples to oranges, but this year's crop of apples to next year's crop of oranges. The accountability system that Utah has been working on for years and is just about finished with measures individual student growth. And what we're trying to get at here, theoretically in No Child Left Behind, is a measure of student growth, a measure of what individuals are doing and how much progress they're making, not a measure of what one cohort does from one year, right, one year to the next.
Dwayne, one word more from you, if I can get it.
Well, I think, you know, going to the point that David's making in regards to that, still the concern when you set benchmarks around the country and you say, how is my African-American students doing in regards to their white peers? And I think you have to measure that. I think if we look at just a growth factor and saying, you know, Johnny's two grade levels behind, but he's making progress, but at the end of the day, he can't match, he can't pass our state accountability test, our U-Biscuit and our CRTs and things like that. You know, I'm hearing that argument each and every day now as parents are saying, you know,
What you're saying, Dwayne, is that there is more of a push for bringing up the level of education for minority students in No Child Left Behind. That's what you're worried about losing.
I think as a minority representative, I believe we need to continue to raise that bar and not do just enough to get by.
Thanks for being with us, Dwayne.
Thank you.
Dwayne Bordeaux there on the line from Salt Lake City, where he is Democratic State Representative. Katie, just a quick word from you on something that's come up a couple of times, and that is this idea that No Child Left Behind imposes a kind of a grid or a system or a structure in some states where it doesn't fit as well as other states, and that's never really been properly addressed.
Well, it actually has been addressed. While the argument is that NCLB imposes a kind of one-size-fits-all accountability.
NCLB is No Child Left Behind.
I just need
to remember that.
I'm sorry. If you actually look at the state accountability systems that have been approved by the federal government, there are almost endless variations. In Massachusetts, for example, they wanted to show, give schools credit for progress for getting children from a very low level of achievement up, even if they didn't quite hit the proficient level. The federal government approved that. I mean, there are a variety of flexible elements that were allowed by the federal government. So this kind of notion that there's no flexibility is simply wrong. And one point, if I could, on mm-hmm. Utah actually does not have an accountability system in place. It has a plan to have an accountability system.
Well, David just said they had one that's even more sophisticated
than
No Child
Left. They absolutely do not. They have a plan to have one that they hope will be more sophisticated, but there is no accountability system in place in Utah at this point. And they have absolutely resisted, as Dwayne indicated, having any kind of goals in their system for improving the achievement of groups of kids who are behind, specifically low-income and minority students. The state of Utah has rejected that out of hand.
David?
The UPass system that Utah is working on and has been working on is something that they've put a tremendous amount of energy into, and the reason they like it is because it incorporates growth factors into the calculation.
But it's not in place yet. That's what Katie's saying.
It's not officially in place because they have tried to use the federal accountability system and have toyed with it until they found that it doesn't work, which is part of the reason why they're reverting back to their designed plan that's not fully implemented yet.
All right, let's hear from some of our callers. First to Cary, North Carolina. Rick's joining us on the line. Hey, Rick.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call.
Yeah.
I come from this from two different points of view. First, I have two young children in elementary and middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm seeing here, and they're both in magnet schools, is that they're not getting a full, well-rounded education because the teachers are tending to teach for them to pass the end-of-grade test, which is a part of No Child Left Behind. So it's kind of lowering the bar to the point of where, okay, we're just going to teach what you need to know to pass the test.
Do you know what they're... Sorry, Rick, to interrupt. Do you know what your kids are missing by following that testing regimen? I mean, I've heard people say not enough arts, not enough music, not enough this, not enough that, because of the concentration on teaching to the test. Have you looked that closely into it?
Well, they're both in what down here. One's in a creative arts and sciences elementary school, and the other one is in a another creative middle school. And the schools are very high ranked, but they're both getting arts and language and everything, but where I see more of the gaps are they're being taught more specifically to pass more of the criteria in the math, in the history, in the English, social studies.
Uh-huh.
That's where I see the gaps happening. And on the other side of the point, I'm also a faculty member at a university here. And the freshmen that I see starting to come in, it's the same pattern. I mean, I had a class this morning where I was asking some basic questions concerning some historical facts in the U.S., and everybody looked at me like they didn't know what I was talking about.
Now, these are freshmen who would have had, what, 2, maybe even 3 years of No Child Left Behind testing in their final years of high school?
Yes.
And you're saying that they're not as well-prepared or as broadly read or taught as the students who came before them?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. They don't have more of the broad depth. They're hitting, you know, they basically passed the test,
right.
But they don't have the broad reach as far as a little bit of everything.
Teaching to the test, Katie, it's one of the big knocks against No Child Left Behind, and we're hearing Rick's sort of firsthand experience. What do you make of that?
Well, let me say two things about that. First of all, testing in North Carolina has not changed one bit under No Child Left Behind. In other words, the tests that were in place prior to the passage of No Child Left Behind as the state's own accountability system are still in place today. And frankly, the same thing is true in Texas. And there's a lot of misinformation out there about the testing requirements of No Child Left Behind in both North Carolina and Texas. The same set of tests are in place today as were in place prior to No Child Left Behind.
Is there perhaps a different stress on those tests since No Child Left Behind introduced this notion of, you know, the school being a passing school or a failing school? I mean, really, it turned up the heat under the schools to apply the test, did it not?
It's at some level, but in both Texas and North Carolina, these were very tough accountability systems predating No Child Left Behind. In fact, those two states' accountability systems were, in many ways, the model behind No Child Left Behind. So there is a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of misinformation out there about the effects of state testing programs more generally, which date back in most states at least 10 years, as opposed to the pressure of No Child Left Behind, which simply is the added pressure of saying, not only do you have to do well by some of your students, but you actually have to bring up the performance of the kids that you've been hiding underneath the overall averages for which you've been held accountable before. Now, I don't want to dismiss out of hand the issue of teaching to the test. This has been a problem in American education, frankly, since well before No Child Left Behind. What's sad about it is that the research is really quite clear. If you want your students to do well on state tests, the best thing to do as a teacher is not to drill them to the tests, but to teach them to the state standards. And it's only that sort of richer education that will actually propel students forward on not just the state test, but any other test they take as well. So I'm not suggesting it is not a problem. But the sad part of that practice is it will not produce results.
All right, Rick, thanks very much for your call. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation this hour about No Child Left Behind. We're reading lots in the newspaper about states and school districts, the teachers' union. People are starting to speak out about this. Does that mean that there is, in fact, rising discontent in the country over the way that the act is being applied? Or is it political? How do you see it? We're going to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for our next call. And Richard's with us. Hi, Richard.
Dick, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I do want to make a couple of points about how the public school advocates have asked for this, this very thing they're complaining about. A couple of points. He who pays the piper calls the tune. For years, the public school teachers and the unions have asked for the Department of Education, have asked for federal funding. It's a fact. Every time the government funds something, it necessarily starts meddling in the content. Second, it's not more expensive to teach phonics, for example, than the whole word method, yet it's well known that the whole word method has caused illiteracy.
Are you saying that the schools, Richard, brought this problem on themselves, or are you saying it's not a problem?
I'm saying they brought the problem on themselves. Not only are they not teaching kids, but this, quote, remedy of the NCLB, that the remedies they're complaining about, they don't have enough time to test, they don't have the money and this and that. They asked for this problem because government funding from the federal source has to have strings attached with it. They complain about testing, for example. It takes less money and time to test than to teach in the classroom. And as I mentioned before, the kids would not be illiterate if they taught phonics. It takes just as many hours to teach phonics as to teach a bogus method called whole word that leaves the kids illiterate. And the last point.
Richard, let me take the first point that you raised about, you know, the teachers, the schools, in effect, asking for this extra money and then complaining about the fact that it came with some certain requirement. David, is that legitimate?
Well, indeed, federal money always comes with strings attached to it. The question is how far-reaching and how thick are the strings? And in No Child Left Behind, our task force found that they were too far-reaching and too thick and too punitive. If you look at the accountability measure required under No Child Left Behind, which is imposed on all states, even those states that Katie, you know, recognized as having an existing testing system, the accountability measures, or the way you calculate whether a school is failing or passing, are imposed from the federal government. And they are incredibly punitive. As a matter of fact, one of the few things that held this bill up when it was going through Congress was that the Congressional Research Service was estimating that 90% to 95% of schools were going to be ultimately labeled as not performing or failing schools. You've got a system that is designed to over-identify failure, and it's very good at doing that. It over-identifies failure. It becomes a proxy for diversity in schools. And it offers consequences that have some ridiculous consequences themselves. One of the consequences we found when we were doing our task force studies was that a principal of an elementary school in the Valley, in the Central Valley in California, who had about 75% migrant kids in his school, he knew he would never make AYP because they were always going to be deficient in...
That's a measure of average year progress.
Adequate yearly progress. Okay, he knew they would never meet the federal yardstick for performing well because his kids would never be able to read English because he had about 75% limited English proficient and about a 50% turnover. So the consequences of his kids not being able to speak English because they came from another country is that he's going to have to lay off his federally funded Title I reading teacher because his kids can't meet the reading standards. He's going to have to lay her off, set the money aside for providing busing and providing supplemental services for individual students. That just doesn't make sense.
Let me just nip back to Richard in Chapel Hill. These kinds of problems, I mean, we hear them reported right across the country. Richard, your thoughts?
Dick, I'm just saying it doesn't address the point. As I said, teaching methods like phonics versus whole word.
Let's not go to phonics and whole word because it's
you just mentioned kids can't read.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with money or government mandates. It has to do with a faulty teaching method. And it takes no more money or time to teach the right method versus the wrong method. That's what has to be changed. And I'll just leave with one more point. These same public school teachers for years, every single one I've ever talked to, every poll I've ever seen, are big advocates of government regulation of business. Those are all unfunded mandates. Business every day faces mandates from government on minimum wage, factory standards, product safety. But there's no funding associated with it. So it's a hypocrisy on the part of these public school teachers who are big advocates of government intervention in business now to be crying in their beer because they're being told what to do without any funding.
All right, let's talk about those unfunded mandates when we come back after the break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Really, that's a fancy way of saying that rules and restrictions were put in place and the money wasn't put there to allow those schools and the teachers to meet those different measures of performance. Unfunded mandates is the word. What do you think? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Katie Haycock is with me this hour. She is director of the Education Trust and one of the architects of No Child Left Behind. David Shreve is also with us from the same studio in Washington. He's with the National Conference of State Legislatures, an organization that has been very critical, raising a lot of questions about the usefulness of No Child Left Behind. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We want to know what you're thinking. So we'll go next to Julie in North Carolina, and Robert's on the line. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
I'm fine. What do you think?
Well, I think the issue of accountability is hard to overlook in all the, especially the federal legislation.
Whose accountability, Robert?
Well, okay, we start dealing with an issue of trust. The federal government basically doesn't trust the states to do their job, and the states' legislatures don't trust the local systems to do their job, and the superintendents don't trust the teachers and principals to do their job. So we put in this whole system of testing where we're dealing with the whole issue of distrust all the way up and down the line. Somewhere at the bottom of that, after you spend all the money on testing and checks to make sure your dollar is going to the right place, there's a child who may or may not be the recipient of some of that funding.
Well, I'm glad you wound up with the child, because that's sort of what it's all about. How does that student get the best education? Is it through the kind of system in No Child Left Behind that's designed to help the kids who we're told really need that help?
Well, from in North Carolina, at least in the system that I'm familiar with, I think a lot of dancing goes around to make the numbers to get the federal dollar, and some of the children are getting the appropriate education, and some of them are sort of getting hidden.
Right.
So their category or their statistics aren't glaring in terms of not meeting a federal mandate. But the other piece is that schools and the job of schools should be looked at in the context of society as a whole. And if our society is built on family and schools and church, then the dynamic of what's going on in the schoolhouse has to be balanced with what's going on elsewhere in our society.
And Robert, I'm going to take the very first part of what you said, the accountability and the trust that seems to be lacking in the system, because I'm interested in hearing from both Katie and David about how political the criticism over No Child Left Behind really is. And Katie, why don't you start? Because I think you've got an idea that it's, in fact, very political.
Well, all I can tell you is I hear a lot more criticism at the kind of upper political levels in states than I do when I meet with local teachers and administrators who are doing the work every single day of trying to raise achievement for poor kids and kids of color. I mean, just 2 weeks ago when I was in Connecticut, for example, in the morning I was with the State Board of Education, and big time political. We wanted to discuss the fight with the federal government about NCLB. That very afternoon, I had spent the afternoon with school board members and superintendents from the highest poverty school districts in the state of Connecticut. The subject of NCLB came up not a single time. They wanted simply to have some help in knowing what they needed to do to raise the achievement of the kids that they serve. So I have the feeling that while all this is going on in sort of the air wars, that out in the trenches, teachers and administrators are largely buckling down, learning better and better strategies to take all kids to higher levels of achievement, because that's what this is about. Results are showing that out.
Staying with the politics for a minute here, are you saying that No Child Left Behind is used as a stick by Democrats to hit the Republican administration?
Well, we're in a highly partisan time. It's not a surprise that this is happening, but do remember, and this is something that a lot of your listeners may not know, the major intellectual architects of No Child Left Behind were Senator Ted Kennedy and Congressman George Miller, two liberal Democrats with a long-time history of caring both about dollars for public education, but especially about achievement for poor kids and kids of color.
Okay, but Kennedy's on the record saying it's a great idea, it's just not getting the money it needs.
But he has not backed away from the need to implement this law as is, regardless of dollars. And that's hugely important for people to know.
David, what do you think about the politics here? Is it really a political issue more than it is an education issue?
It may be to some, but it's certainly not to me. You look across the country at what's happening, and you look at the response of the of legislatures and of state governments and of local governments, and you'll see just a swath across the country, from the most conservative and Republican states in the country to probably the most Democrat states in the country as well.
Give me a snapshot, like Katie did from Connecticut. Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Well, you've got, I like to look at this week, in the last couple of weeks, I like to look at what's going on in Utah and Texas and in Connecticut. In Utah, you've got the frustration expressed by the legislature through legislative action, which essentially says we're going to use our system, which is designed for our state and our students, and we're going to use that in preference over the federal system. So you have a legislative response to that kind of frustration. Across the country, in Connecticut, all they said was that they wanted enough flexibility in their plan that's approved by the federal government that they could continue doing what they've done for years and years and years prior to NCLB, which is to gather data by testing every other year. The superintendent in Connecticut made a very strong case that they have plenty of data. They know where their problems are. They don't need to do more testing and gather more data. They need to have more solutions and more resources to put towards solutions. The response from the U.S. Department of Education was, no, you have to do it our way. And then the response from Connecticut was to threaten to file a lawsuit against the feds for not providing enough funds to do what the state needs to do. And in between those two states, you have Texas, which a couple of weeks ago, the state superintendent, looking at the results of the test, just arbitrarily decided that they were going to exempt 90% of the special ed kids from the grade level test that's required under NCLB. Again, expressing the frustration that state and local administrators have over some rigid provisions of this law.
All right, Connection listeners, how do you see it where your children go to school? Boston, Massachusetts. Lauren's on the line. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I tutor students in the Boston Public School who are in danger of not graduating high school because they're in danger of not passing the MCAS.
How long have you been doing that, Lauren?
3 years at least.
Okay.
And what I notice is, for my students, we look at their MCAS scores and we say, you got 21 questions right, you need 23 questions right to pass the exam. So we tutor these kids hours on end, most of whom don't speak English as a first language, to make this 23 question right mark. And then they pass the exam and then they can pass high school. And you're telling me that a high school student whose English proficiency skills are very low but can pass high school with a 23 point mark goes out into the world, what is this child going to do with his education? It's not a real education.
What would you sooner be tutoring then, Lauren, if you weren't teaching to the test as you're describing? What would you sooner be doing with that student?
Most of the students who I see weren't even educated in their native language. That is, they don't even know how to read and write in Spanish, in Russian, whatever language we get. And so we need to go from the basic level, teach these students how to read, how to write, how to do basic mathematics skills. These things aren't being taught. We're teaching how to solve, you know, brain teaser-like questions on the MCAS. The MCAS has made great progress in terms of trying to match the test to the curriculum. But still, there are so many students who are just, you know, barely getting by, getting under the fence, so to speak, just with this, you know, minimal level standard, and then they can graduate high school and they still don't really know how to speak English.
Lauren, just stay with me for half a sec if you would. I want to bring John in. John's called in from Louisville, Kentucky. John, you're on the local public school board there, right?
Now, actually, I belong on a decision board for the local schools here, and there's a number of different entities that help govern the school. I'm a parent that belongs on that board.
Right.
You know, in our family, and we're in a situation to where, you know, our kids are not one of those at-risk areas, and our kids do fine in the public schools. I think the problem, and the one thing that I liked about seeing the No Child Left Behind come, is that you could clearly see that at-risk kids were not getting the attention shown to them as they should,
right,
throughout the entire country. And the you know, I'm.
But we just listened to Lauren saying that the pressure on her to tutor some of those kids directly aimed at the testing doesn't seem to be working from her perspective.
Yeah, but but what happens here, at least from what I've seen, is that if you don't really know and understand or shine light on a problem, you can't solve the problem. And what happened, I can say here and in other districts, my mom's a high school teacher in Florida, and we've talked about this several times. And you know, the you start to shine light on schools, like the school that you mentioned in California, to where, you know, before No Child Left Behind came, first of all, there were different standards for different states, and it was hard, in my opinion, for the federal government to say, okay, we're going to try to take this apples and oranges type of system and figure out how we can help children throughout the United States get better by the funding dollars we have. Now it's a situation to where you're really starting to shine light on the problem areas, and then we can adjust the system to address that. Because frankly, you know, my kids and other kids like mine aren't the ones who are at risk of not having the adequate attention shown to them. And if it's a scenario to where we discover that there's a lot more children than we realize that are at risk.
John, let me just ask Lauren to come back in here on the very point that you're making about at least using No Child Left Behind as a flashlight, as a way of shining light on a problem. Does it work from that perspective, Lauren?
It works to some extent, but it also, you know, you have money. There's a Brook School in Dorchester has been, you know, there's light been shine on it saying that this school is not meeting standard, and there's still no money, and, you know, progress is being made at a very slow pace. Progress is being made, but still, my concern is the basic level of education that these students are receiving is not sufficient. It's an education that, you know, you can pass the MCAS, or maybe you can pass the SATs. How does this enable you? You don't have the basic skills, reading, writing, mathematical skills to go out into the workforce, to go out into life and support yourself.
All right, Lauren, I thank you for your call, and John as well. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. No Child Left Behind. How is it working in the place where you are, and how do you see it there? Let's go back to David Shreve and Katie Haycock in our Washington studio. And Katie, maybe I can start with you. People seem to want to have the program working and are saying that it's not. Would you just say to them, be more patient, or does it really need some kind of a 3-year renovation now?
Well, what I would say is, look at where the kids are. I mean, I share Lauren's sense of urgency. This is not just about getting kids to pass a test. This is about fundamentally reshaping the quality of education that we provide to make sure that all American young people have the education that they need to become productive citizens. In Massachusetts, and I want to be clear about this, the test that she's talking about was the MCAS, was put into place well before No Child Left Behind. It is actually one of the best high school exit tests in the country in terms of students required to read extensively, to write about what they're reading, and to answer questions. The only way you can pass that test is if you've been educated to read things and to write things. The good news here is, if you look at the data, and I think all of us have to sort of suspend judgment here and look at student achievement data. And what we see is so interesting, because after making a lot of progress during the 70s and 80s in this country and raising achievement among poor children and minority children, that stopped during the 1990s, and the gap that actually separates them from white kids grew wider. If you look, however, at data from the last 3 years since No Child Left Behind passed, at the elementary level, it is very clear we have turned that corner. Achievement in the vast majority of states, achievement is up, and achievement is up more for poor children and children of color.
David, would you quarrel with that statistic?
I would quarrel with attributing it to No Child Left Behind. Katie's made a very strong point that so many states had testing systems and accountability systems in place long before No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind is a federal attempt to hijack the standards-based reform movement and take credit for it. And in doing so, the federal government set up a very rigid system of standards-based reform, applied it to all the states equally, even though we all knew that at the time there were probably between 6 and 10 states that needed that kind of boost from the federal government to get up to a basic level of standards-based reform. And that was probably very good for those states. But the other 40 states or 40 or more states were brought down to that same level as well. That's why you have these complications like in Texas, in Florida, in North Carolina, where under the state accountability system, schools are being rewarded by the state, and at the same time, they're being punished by the federal government. It sends a very confusing message to parents, to administrators, to the whole public at large, and it makes it very confusing upon the kids. It doesn't help their education to be labeled as a failing school under the federal law and an A-plus school under the Florida Sunshine Law.
Let's go to Charlottesville, Virginia. Scott's been waiting on the line from there. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I just wanted to make a real quick comment. You were asking about whether this was a political issue or not previously. I'm from a conservative state, Virginia, and we did have standards-based reform a while ago, which I think is fairly broadly supported, and we also had standardized testing. Interestingly, our state legislature is now fighting this bill, largely because it's not really intended to be a reform bill. It's a poison pill bill, with the notion that if you deliver some funding kind of as a carrot, you can start to begin to label schools as failing and begin to sort of attack the public school system in general by marking it as failing. The bill doesn't really make provisions or exceptions for a wide range of students that the government, that the state is mandated to teach, were required to teach by law, who have absolutely no chance of ever passing these standards.
Right. Scott, I don't know how much money Virginia gets as part of the No Child Left Behind Act, but are you saying that the state would be better off without that money and without the requirements?
I think that's absolutely correct. We have our own standards-based reform movement. There's an attempt to get very serious about teacher accountability and school accountability, and I think that's fairly broadly supported as a general political principle. I think what's going on with the Bush administration in particular and their education department is an attempt to attack public school education in general.
All right, Scott, I'm going to interrupt you because I'm right at the end of the program. Katie Haycock, last word to you. Do you think that No Child Left Behind, the Act, its principles, do you think that they're in jeopardy based on what we're hearing?
No, I actually don't. I think that when the law comes around for reauthorization in 2006-07, it is likely, based on our experience and based on data at that time, that Congress will make, as it always makes, some modifications designed to actually improve the way it functions. But I do not think this Congress, and I mean both Democrats and Republicans, will abandon the notion that we need to make our schools work for all kids.
Katie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Katie Haycock is Director of the Education Trust, and David Treve, I appreciate your coming in as well.
Thank you.
David is Senior Committee Director for Education for the National Conference of State Legislatures. Earlier in the program, we talked with Randall Eigelhar, teacher at the Mark Twain Middle School in San Antonio, Texas, and Duane Bordeaux, Democratic State Representative from Utah. The Connection is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.